This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivisodhi. Now, that was a long speech by Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin. There's a lot of money that's been given out. But you know what? It's our Doctor in the House series. It's Friday and on the line with me is Dr. George Lee. How are you, Dr. George?
I'm very good. No, that was indeed a long speech. And I was waiting for that crucial moment to say, when can we do the state capital?
So he covered just about everything without telling us whether this CMCO is going to be extended or not, or whether it was coming to an end on Tuesday. I'm assuming there's going to be another speech, in the next couple of days. Yeah. How are you, George? How are you doing?
I'm good. Well, just finished work, you know. I think things are picking up, and then more and more people are just observing the rules to wash the hands and the sanitizer, the gloves and everything. I really think that, everyone's coming together to make sure that the infection doesn't get out of hand.
Yes, right? I know. And I think the golden question now is, and there's a lot of talk about this, and a lot of people don't really want to embark on this conversation because understanding viruses can be a little bit... it can be...
Mind-boggling.
Yes, exactly, but I love them. I know they're rascals. I've always said that in the past. We have on the line with us to help us understand. And the question is, has the coronavirus mutated? We've seen so many articles coming out from all over the world saying that there are different types, type A, B, C. Some of them have said that this virus has mutated, that it's become less virulent, that it's infecting people less. But we're going to get the lowdown from a virologist and the CEO of the DBT Wellcome Trust India Alliance, Dr. Shahid Jamil. Welcome to the show, Dr. Shahid. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And, Dr. Shahid has worked on the hepatitis virus as well as HIV. Haven't you, Dr. Shahid?
Yes, I did. And I also worked on the SARS-1 virus.
Yeah. So that's perfect. So can we just go through a very basic question first? Now, we talk about different strains or mutations of SARS-CoV-2, right? Which we use interchangeably as COVID-19. Is that accurate? Is that the same thing?
Well, COVID-19 is a disease. SARS-CoV-2 is the virus. So it's sort of like HIV and HIV.
Right. It's like HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, so HIV is the disease, is the virus. AIDS is the disease. Similarly, SARS-CoV-2 is the virus, and COVID-19 is the disease.
Okay. So we've heard of different types of this virus. We've heard of the type A, the type B, the type C. A mostly in Europeans and Americans, B mostly in East Asia, C mostly in Europeans and Americans. What is this? I mean, help us understand this a little bit better.
Well, first of all, these are not different strains of virus. And something that's been out there, especially in the lay press, is that there are different strains of virus. To a virologist, a different strain of virus is something that has a fundamentally different property, such as binding to a different receptor, having a different way of transmitting, having a remarkably different temperature stability. Those strains would be different strains. What we are seeing is a single strain, but there are different isolates, meaning that if you are in Malaysia and the virus is isolated from you, it becomes a Malaysian isolate. If I'm in India and the virus is isolated from me, it becomes an Indian isolate. So that's how we look at it. So first of all, these are not strains, these are isolates. The second point is that viruses are mutating all the time. They're changing their genomes all the time. And there is a perfect biochemical scientific reason for it. And that is that when the genome of the virus replicates, when the RNA replicates to produce more RNA, to produce more virus, there is an inherent error in this replication. Even in our own genomes, there is an error every time our genome replicates. But we have enzymes to correct those mistakes in replication. Most viruses do not have that error-correcting mechanism. And that's why they mutate much faster on our time scales compared to our own genomes. Having said that, coronaviruses are really very unique RNA viruses because they have this error-correcting mechanism. So that's why coronaviruses don't change, don't mutate as much as other viruses. For example, the influenza virus. And it's been seen that coronaviruses only, their mutation rate is about 1,000 times less than the mutation rate of most other RNA viruses.
Can we just take a step back when you spoke about the genetic makeup and that how it changes, right? And that's when the viruses actually mutate. Having said that, when they actually mutate and this genetic makeup changes, that can work against the virus as well. It can work to our favor as well. Am I correct?
Right. That is correct. The only thing is in evolution, you will only see things that will work in favor of the virus. If there is something that is deleterious to the virus, if there is a mutation, and these mutations happen all the time, but you never see those viruses because they are selected against and their population vanishes. So you only see things that are that are beneficial in some way to the virus. Okay.
Yeah, Professor Ashai, if you could consider it that way, that the virus is always mutating to the advantage of survival. However, there's this talk about the infectiousness or the toxicity of the virus getting less. Is there such a concept of the virus itself is getting less virulent now?
Well, see, common sense says that when a virus jumps from another species, let's say into the human, or across any species, its spread and its disease-causing ability is usually higher. And as time goes on, as the virus adapts to the new environment, to the new host, it moderates its virulence. It moderates its ability to cause disease. It is of no real benefit to a virus to have a dead host, because viruses transmit from one host to another, and they are transmitted much better when there is a living host, a host that can sneeze, a host that can cough, a host that can have sex, a host that can move around. Then viruses spread. Mm-hmm. That host is of no consequence to the virus. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So on that note, the type A, type B, type C, which you mentioned that are just different variants in different part of the world, is that part of the evolution of the virus in order to survive better, or is just a simply a random chance?
So that is something called the founder effect. And the founder effect is that if I'm infected, let's step back a little. The mutation rate of the SARS coronavirus 2, in fact, all coronaviruses, has been estimated to be roughly 10 to the power of minus 6 per nucleotide per cycle, which essentially means that for every replication cycle, there is a 1 millionth chance that a particular base in the virus will undergo a change, okay? Now, the other fact is that a 1 ml of sputum carries roughly 10 to the 7 viral particles, which means that in 1 ml of sputum, you would have every single nucleotide in the virus mutated at least once, okay? So it's a it's really a population of viruses, right? So when this sputum transmits the virus to somebody else, there is a chance that a certain mutation will survive better in the new host compared to the older host.
Right.
So that population propagates. And this is something we call the founder effect. So if the virus came, let's say, from Wuhan into Malaysia, and you know it started transmitting a certain kind of virus, then within the Malaysian population, you'll see a spreading of that kind of virus. If the virus came to India and a certain other mutant started circulating, the virus in India in due course would look a bit different from the virus in Malaysia. So this is something which we call the founder effect.
But what determines
that? And that is
that,
why you see...
What determines that spread? I mean, is it the our gene makeup of the host? Or what determines what is spreading in the individual countries?
It's mostly chance. But yes, the genetic makeup of the population will also determine it to some extent. But largely it's chance. And we are assuming that all of these different mutants are spreading with almost equal efficiency. So it's really a matter of chance which virus takes hold initially when the virus comes into a population and then starts spreading within that population.
Okay, interesting. You have said that viruses don't aim to kill its host. And that makes sense. If it kills all its hosts, it dies, right? It's got nowhere, nowhere else
right.
to live. So does that mean that if, in order not to kill all its hosts, it then has to, it's forced to become less disruptive? How does it ensure that it's not killing all its hosts? And do you think COVID-19 has already struck that sort of perfect balance?
Just want to disrupt people.
COVID-19, we feel, is still a virus that is evolving. It's not spread in the human population long enough to have really moderated its virulence. There are other coronaviruses that have circulated in the human population for about 100 years. And these have become endemic in the human population. And today, about 20 to 30% of the common cold that you get on an annual basis is because of those other coronaviruses. They don't kill. They cause a very mild disease, and you know you don't even notice sometimes. Mm-hmm. Eventually, we feel that this virus will become like that. But we can't wait for that to happen because, first of all, we can't predict how long it will take to become a virus that's endemic in the population and therefore harmless. We need to make sure that we take all precautions now.
But we can certainly hope for it, isn't it?
Yeah. Dr. Sahi, on that note, I wonder whether you can clarify a little bit what happens to SARS virus 17 years ago. Does it still exist in human or has gone back to the bat or it's just disappeared from the face of Earth?
I think it just stopped transmitting. Viruses never disappear. The only virus that the world has eliminated is smallpox, which means that there are no stocks of smallpox anywhere. There is no smallpox in any human or animal populations. There are related viruses like monkeypox, which are there. So I feel that the SARS-1 virus just stopped transmitting because, first of all, it was not a very good transmitter compared to this virus. And secondly, people got immunity against that virus in areas where it was spreading.
So on that note, that SARS stopped transmitting, it's still within the host, i.e. the human being somewhere. And then does that mean that it somehow the virulence has decreased because our immunity built up? And is there a way that it will re-emerge, SARS will re-emerge somewhere in the future?
Okay, so I don't believe that the SARS-1 virus is still in humans. It may be in the environment. It may be in back in an animal reservoir as maybe a different virus or a slightly different virus. We don't know that yet. But yes, there is always a possibility that another SARS-like virus will emerge. 17 years later, SARS-CoV-2 did emerge. However, it has not emerged directly from SARS-CoV-1, because if you look at the sequence homology between SARS-1 and SARS-2, it's only about 80%. Whereas SARS-2 is more closely related to a bat virus that was isolated in China in 2018. And it's also very closely related to a virus found in pangolins. And there, the homology is somewhere in the range of 90 to 96%. So it's more close to animal viruses than it is to the SARS-CoV-1 virus. It's called SARS-CoV-2 because it is showing the same type of symptoms. SARS stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. So both viruses cause the same kind of disease, and that's why we're calling it SARS-CoV-2.
Right.
But it's really more related to the bat and pangolin viruses than to the SARS-1 virus.
So we're discussing, should we worry that the coronavirus is mutating? When we come back, we will be discussing, you know, whether or not the virus will continue to spread as long as we have susceptible and infected people. And most importantly, a lot of countries in the world are sort of loosening their lockdown. And there's a lot of talk about a second wave. How do we ensure that the second wave of COVID-19 is not devastating here and all over the world? That's coming up next. If you have a question for us, give us a call. It's 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, on the line with me, together with Dr. Shahid Jamil, virologist and CEO of the DBT Wellcome Trust India Alliance. We are discussing whether we should worry that the coronavirus is mutating. So we've gone through certain having a basic understanding of what this virus is, viruses in general, as well as SARS-CoV-2, and the difference between COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2. That's interesting. One is the virus, which is SARS-CoV-2. COVID-19 is the disease, like we would refer to HIV as the virus and AIDS as the disease. And then we have isolates, the types that we talk about, A, B and C. According to Dr. Shahid, he has explained to us that these are isolates depending on how these viruses sort of present in different countries. And so hence the reason why we see A, B and C, some in European and American country in Americas and in East Asia for some. And then we also understand now that all viruses mutate, whether we like it or not, depending on the genetic makeup. And it's good to know that the coronavirus generally sort of mutates at a much slower pace than the flu virus, for an example. Am I correct, Dr. Shahid?
Yes, that's correct.
So let's go on to say now, if the coronavirus mutates at a much slower rate, does that mean it's easier to come up with a vaccine?
Yes, absolutely.
So what's taking them so long?
you do realize that the way vaccine for coronavirus is working right now is unprecedented in history. From the day the virus sequence was available in early January, it took only 63 days for the first candidate vaccine to be start testing in humans. That has never happened. The closest we came to was at SARS one time, when it took about 20 months before a vaccine could reach that stage. And by that time, the virus had essentially finished its job. So a vaccine was not needed. Today, the technology is come up real fast and has gone far. So now, at this time, there are more than 130 different vaccine candidates that are in development. 10 of these vaccines are already being tested in humans. This is unprecedented. Vaccines do take time to develop. because we want the product to be both efficacious as well as safe. It will take time because testing has to go through certain protocols.
And let's talk about Italy now. The virus was more fatal. It would seem it was more fatal in Italy than in China. Was it really the case, Dr. Shahid?
Well, Italy did have a lot of mortality, and so did US. I mean, if you look at New York City, you wouldn't think that you were talking about a developed country. But the key factor is, when do you start becoming very serious about controlling your outbreak? And Italy, Spain, US, all took their own time putting in measures that were required to control the outbreak. They just let the virus run free in the population. And unfortunately, the population paid for it.
So lockdowns were really the way to manage it, Dr. Shahid?
I'm not saying that nationwide lockdowns are really the best strategy, but getting the communication out very clearly, taking all the steps to prevent person-to-person transmission is the key. Many countries have gone into nationwide lockdowns, including mine. There are other countries, on the other hand, that have gone into something called shelter in place. People are being told to isolate themselves without having police patrolling the streets to enforce that. So different countries have used different strategies. But the key thing is for people to understand the importance of distancing, people to understand the importance of measures such as putting on a mask and hand hygiene. Those are really the only measures we have available to us today.
What's your take on wearing masks?
Excuse me. I think masks are needed, masks are required, masks are protective. If there are two people across from each other and both are not wearing a mask, the chance of transmission is high. If one is wearing a mask, it's moderate. If both are wearing a mask, the chance is low. It makes absolute sense to be wearing a mask. And I'm not advocating wearing an N95 mask. Leave that mask for the healthcare workers. We really need to be wearing simple cloth masks, something that is two or three layers, something that you can bring home and wash with soap and water. Just practice that and practice good hand hygiene.
After the lockdown, doctors in Italy now seem to think that the virus is losing steam, Dr. Shahid. The WHO has warned that there is no evidence to prove this claim. I, for one, was consoled and terribly enthusiastic when I read these reports from the doctors from Italy. Please, what is your take on this?
I don't think we have given enough time for the virus to evolve enough to lose steam.
It's still having a party, huh? It's still not done.
Absolutely, absolutely. I see in my own country, I mean, we went through a two-month lockdown. And as we are emerging from the lockdown, the cases are spiking up. Every day you see cases more than the previous day. So no, the virus is definitely not losing steam.
So if the virus is not losing steam, and then you mentioned that 2 months is, or we're not giving enough time, how long do you think is enough time?
I don't know. We can't predict that. But we have to take all these precautions, not because we will stop the virus from transmitting. The virus will find gaps in our strategy and will transmit. All we're trying to do is spread out the transmission over a period of time so that when any of us get sick, there are still hospital beds available for us and facilities available to us.
So, Dr. Shahi, on that note, do you think we will ever see the course of COVID-19 to follow what SARS did, effectively cause havoc for a long time and then, well, for an interval and then just disappear from face of earth, which is what a lot of us are hoping for?
I don't foresee that happening in the near future. And I'll tell you why. There is very critical difference between SARS-1 and SARS-2. SARS-1, the virus transmits only a few days after symptoms appear. SARS-2, the virus starts transmitting a couple of days before symptoms appear. So in COV-1, people, only symptomatic people were transmitting, and therefore it was easy to restrict. In COV-2, a lot of asymptomatics are transmitting, and that's why it is so hard to control transmission. SARS-1 only infected about 8,000 people. SARS-2 has by now infected over 6.7 million people around the world. There's a fundamental difference between these two viruses, and this is based on the property of their transmission. And because of that, I don't really think that this virus is going to just one day disappear, just like the SARS-1 disappeared.
You've just crushed all hopes that I've had, Dr. Shahid. I mean, voila. I'm just holding on to that one day it will moderate like SARS-1 did. I'm still going to hope. We'll come back and find out. How do we ensure when we sort of release this lockdown, how do we ensure that the second wave of COVID-19 is not devastating? That's coming up next. If you have a question, once again, call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. It's our Doctor in the House series. Today, we are discussing whether we should worry that COVID-19 is mutating. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on the line with me, and Dr. Shahid Jamil, virologist and CEO of the DBT Wellcome Trust India Alliance. So, verdict is the virus is mutating, whether we like it or not, as we go along. However, the good news is, in general, the coronavirus mutates at a more stable rate. It doesn't mutate as quickly as the flu viruses. Dr. Shahid, so as long as there are susceptible and infected people in the population, the virus will continue to spread. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Who is a susceptible and infected person? I know. Who is susceptible? Aren't we all susceptible?
We're all susceptible. We can reduce the probability of our being susceptible by practicing good hand hygiene, by wearing masks. But we're all susceptible.
Okay. And when you say we're all susceptible, how do you explain people who are asymptomatic?
Well, that's a different thing. They get infected, but they don't show disease. And this is not just a property of this virus. There are many, many viruses that show this property. Everyone who gets infected doesn't show disease. And that depends on our genetic makeup. Humans are an outbred population. We have different levels of immune protection genes, and therefore we respond very differently to different pathogens. And it's not just viruses. One example I'll give you is tuberculosis. About a third or maybe half of the world's population has been infected with the tuberculosis bug, but everyone doesn't show symptoms. The bacterium is latent. It doesn't cause disease. So this happens to many, many pathogens, including viruses. That's not something unusual.
There were recent reports that people who are asymptomatic carry a lower viral load. Is that true?
Yes, that is by and large true. that the virus doesn't replicate as well. And that is because these people have an immune system that controls the virus early on, something that we call innate immunity. Whereas in others, the virus multiplies much better. And once the virus starts walking down from your upper respiratory system, that is your nasopharyngeal cavity and your throat, into your lungs, that is when the real trouble starts.
Interesting, isn't it, George? Innate immunity. It almost sounds like a privilege. Some of us have innate immunity.
On that basis, do you think that Asian and also on our this side of the world, perhaps we have innate immunity against, you know, if you look at the ranking of the number of countries that were infected, yeah, man's got highest number. Top 10s are all, predominantly Western countries. And then Asians seem to have some sort of immunity. Is that a good perception?
Well, this idea has certainly been going around. And it is interesting that East Asia, South Asia, even though you have high levels of infection, the mortality is lower compared to the West. So it is possible, but there really is no proof of it yet. It's as best as circumstantial evidence.
I just feel privileged, that's all.
Yeah.
Or change.
So, yeah, but don't depend on that.
Okay.
All right. Well, so far, we can call it good fortune, or we can call it innate or vigilance or innate immunity.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Dr. Tahir, I'm going to ask you a very controversial question. All right. Yeah. Obviously, about a month ago, the US president obviously made some implication that this whole virus was manufactured. And WHO obviously is working very hard to trace the origin of this vaccine, the virus itself. I mean, you highlighted earlier on about different modes of transmission, the variability in the virulence of the disease itself. But one thing that actually is quite constant is the genetic makeup of the virus. We even know how many subtypes. Is there any way this virus is manufactured? And is there any way we can trace the origin of the virus?
Well, look, I'm a scientist by training. I'm trained to look at evidence. And today, this whole hypothesis, I wouldn't call it a theory, only a hypothesis, that the virus originated from a lab, the virus was deliberately made in a lab, all these are conjectures. There is no evidence to support this. Whereas there is overwhelming evidence that the virus that we're talking about, its closest relative was found in an animal. And the virus, at some point, jumped from animals into humans. And the only way the virus could have evolved its main protein, the spike protein, to be adapted to the human cells is if it circulated for some time in humans. The other point I would like to highlight is if I, as a virologist, were making a virus in a lab to kill a lot of humans, I would choose a backbone from a virus that was known to cause human disease. I would not choose a bat virus that had never, ever been shown to cause human disease. So, pure logic demands that we simply negate this idea that the virus was made in a lab, unless there is other overwhelming evidence that comes forward. As scientists, we should believe in evidence. So right now, there is overwhelming evidence of its evolution from an animal virus. If the US president can deploy the Secret Service to find evidence for something other than this, let's see.
Well, they've got to be a virologist.
But you know, even the Chinese have claimed, that the virus came to China from US through a military mission. So these are, you know, these charges and countercharges, and we should not waste our time in these things.
So will WHO ever find out the origin of the virus?
It might. It's not just WHO. I mean, it's the countries, really. You know, as more and more virus gets sequenced from different places, we may know what the most recent common ancestor of this virus was. And from there, we may be able to deduce. I mean, today, there are about 37,000 genomic sequences of the COV2 virus in the open database. Anyone can download this and analyze this. And based on this analysis, the most recent common ancestor is placed somewhere around December 2019. It would be very useful to go back to people who had acute pneumonia in periods just before December and look at those samples, if those samples are available, if similar viruses are found there or not. So yes, eventually I think people may find out. But right now the focus is really to control this one rather than worry about what the American president or the Chinese president says.
Well said, Dr. Shahid. How do we ensure that the second wave of COVID-19 is not devastating?
Okay, so there are two things about the second wave. I think we keep talking about the second wave based on what happened in the 1918 flu.
Yep.
The 1918 flu, the first wave was mild. But when the second wave came in September of 1918, that really killed most people. So we are worried that a situation similar to that would happen now. 1918 was a different time than 2020. You realize that in 1918, nobody had even seen a virus. Virus was only a concept. The first picture of a virus became available somewhere in the mid-1930s, a good 15 years after the 1918 flu. And that is because the electron microscope was invented in 1931. So that was a very different time. Today, the technology is that we can go from a virus sequence to a vaccine in essentially 2 months' time. So we are living in a very, very different world today. So we have to keep that in mind when we talk of a second wave. I'm not saying that a second wave won't happen. It will happen if we are careless. And therefore, it is very important for us, as all of us emerge from lockdowns, to be ever more vigilant and to really practice all the non-pharmacological interventions that are being talked about. Again, these are masks, hand hygiene, and maintaining distance. These are the only tools available to us.
But that's on condition that the virus doesn't become, increase its transmissibility.
There is no evidence of the virus increasing its virulence. There is some evidence that the virus may be increasing its transmissibility. If you look at the mutations across the viral genomes, one clade is becoming a dominant clade. And this clade has a mutation in the spike gene, which is close to an area which is called the hinge region of the spike protein. And the hinge region is what gets cleaved for the virus to enter cells. So the mutation that is appearing in this location in about 60% of viruses that are circulating now might make it easier for the virus to enter cells. Again, this is a hypothesis at this time based on what we are seeing. So the virus may be increasing its ability to transmit, its ability to infect cells. But there is no evidence that the virus is increasing its ability to cause disease. These are two different things, and we should keep this in mind.
So until we have enough proof that the virus is actually losing steam, so what would be your advice? Do we just continue to be vigilant?
Continue to be vigilant, yes. And as you're emerging, I was actually looking at data for Malaysia. And Malaysia as a country has done very well, you know, somewhere around 8,250 cases, around 115 deaths, which translates to about 4 deaths per million population. There has been no new deaths reported since May 22nd. However, I noticed that on June 4th, Malaysia has reported 277 cases, which is the highest number of daily cases ever in this outbreak. And you had a peak in around the end of March. Whether this is an isolated case or not, keep an eye on it. I hope this is not something that we are seeing what you call a second wave.
Yeah, unfortunately,
without a mask yesterday.
Unfortunately, 270 of those cases are migrant workers in detention centres. So not something that, you know, we hope will be contained even better. However, obviously the infection in the community is a lot less. So George, would you have a message for us?
Well, I'm just hoping 2 years from today, we're not having a Skype call like this anymore, but perhaps Dr. Shahid in person in the studio rather than actually continue to have this. Because from what you said earlier on, we obviously need to continue vigilance, but I think we also need to live in hope.
That would be a distinct pleasure, George.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Shahid. I mean, it shed so much light on this virus and our understanding of what's really going on. That was Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Dr. Shahid Jamil, a virologist and CEO of the DBT Wellcome Trust India Alliance, speaking to us about whether we should worry that the coronavirus is mutating. On Health and Living, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.